Last week, I began a little two-part series on modeling biblical marriage, sort of in honor of Valentine's and all that that is. And I'm just going to do a brief recap of last week, and then we'll move into this week. I talked about three things. We looked in Revelation, we're talking about the marriage between Christ and the church, and it used some very positive words. It's a celebration and joy and gladness, and I believe that's also what God intends for earthly marriage. But ways that you and I can model biblical marriage for a world that is quickly abandoning marriage as God intended it. The first thing, and maybe the most important thing, is that we share a common faith. If we do not share a common faith, one person will be going in the direction of the Lord, the other one will be going in the direction of the world, and you'll have a tug of war. Secondly, I talked about demonstrating a servant's heart, being willing to serve your spouse. It's more about serving than being served. And then third, I talked about the importance of speaking words of affirmation. Okay, we have to be life-giving in what we say and what we speak to one another. And so I want to begin today with the fourth way that you and I, as married couples, for those of us who are married, can model biblical marriage. Okay? Number four is that we need to be quick to forgive. Quick to forgive. And 1 Corinthians 13, verse 5, speaking of love, it says it keeps no record of wrongs. All right? How many of you know that every marriage is going to have offenses at some point in time? It's going to happen simply because of the closeness of that human relationship. There will be hurts, there will be wounds, there will be offenses, hopefully unintentionally, but the truth is it's going to happen. And when it does, we need to understand that forgiveness is love in action. Because you love your spouse and you think the best about them and that they're good-willed, you will be quick to forgive them, and that's love in action. Biblical love does not keep records. It does not keep score of what your spouse has done wrong. I once heard about an individual who kept a little black book of everything that their spouse did wrong. And it was no wonder that they were married four or five times. And it's very damaging because you keep a record of wrongs, you're not walking in forgiveness. I want to share with you what I think is one of the most important verses in all the Bible. All right, so listen up closely. You're familiar with it, but I really want to talk about its importance. That's in Matthew 6, 14 and verse 15. For if you forgive men their transgressions, your heavenly Father will also forgive you. But if you do not forgive men, then your Father will not forgive your transgressions. Do you realize the magnitude of that verse? That if we are willing to forgive the little that our spouse may do to us, God will forgive the much that we've done against him. But if we're not willing to forgive, if we want to keep records of wrongs and we want to keep score and keep track and pout and kind of hold it against them, God is saying, hey, if you don't forgive them, I won't forgive you. And it piles up and all of a sudden God becomes more and more and more distant from us. And that's a scary, scary place to be. Let me tell you a few of the dangers of unforgiveness as I see it. One thing that unforgiveness will taint our view toward marriage. It will taint our view toward our spouse. All right? And we will see it as far worse than what it really is. And not only that, but unforgiveness toward our spouse will bleed over into all other areas of our life and into all other relationships. I remember one time that I was very happy and content at work, and then went out to lunch with two coworkers who were very angry at the owners of the company, and they spent the entire lunchtime kind of bad-mouthing the owners. And I walked away allowing that to, they planted a seed, and I allowed myself to bite into it. And I became angry and unforgiving toward the owner. And you know what? I went weeks or a month or life became really miserable for me. And when I punched out at 5 o'clock, all of a sudden life didn't get much better when I walked out of the door of work. Is that I carry that attitude, I carry that paintedness home. And it affected my relationship with my wife, my kids, everybody else. And you cannot take unforgiveness and just separate it into this nice, neat little box and be unforgiving toward one person and loving toward everybody else. It doesn't work that way. It will bleed over into all other areas and all other relationships of your life. Which we have to really be careful of people we kind of hang out with, all right? Because just like those coworkers infected me, if you find somebody that is not happy with their spouse, is not happy with their marriage, and you may be, how many of you know that you listen to their negativity, their criticism, and they can infect you? And pretty soon, the joy and the happiness and the contentment you had in your marriage has been overshadowed and tainted and by what this other person has said. You understand what I'm saying here? Unforgiveness will infect your wound and make the pain worse. You know, sometimes as spouses we hurt one another, hopefully not intentionally, but it happens. And if we harbor unforgiveness, it will infect the wound, and it will make the hurt much worse. But if we are willing to speak forgiveness, that's like a healing balm in the relationship. So we have to be, you know, willing to speak forgiveness. And as you know, forgiveness is a decision, but it's also a process. Also, unforgiveness can cause us to adopt a victim's mentality. Woe is me, and that in itself is very destructive and unhealthy. All right, so we have to guard against a victim's mentality, and ultimately unforgiveness will poison our spirit and kill a marriage quicker than just about anything else. You know, it's been said that what you argue about isn't as important as how you argue. Oftentimes, when you look back, it isn't. A lot of people forget what they are even arguing about, but what they remember is the harshness or the tone. Arguing in a proper way versus an improper way. And that's where a lot of the offenses can happen. Proverbs 12:18 says that there is one who speaks rashly like the thrust of a sword. And in the heat of battle, in the midst of the argument, that is easy to do, just to lash out because you're angry. And you want to say something. You want to, it's like a sword. You just want to stick it in them and stick it to them. And doing that will last a lot longer than what you are arguing about. But it says, but the tongue of the wise brings healing. You know, in the midst of the heat of the battle, if we can have a disciplined tongue, we can speak words of life that will not only wound, but move toward healing and full restoration. Gary Thomas said, I don't believe couples fall out of love with one another. We hear people say, well, I just don't love them anymore. I've fallen out of love with them. He says, they don't fall out of love. They really fall out of repentance. You know, and think about that. And we need to be quick to repent. And I love this statement. You got to write this down. I'll repeat it 2 or 3 times. Unforgiveness will harden the softest heart. Forgiveness will soften the hardest heart. One more time. Unforgiveness will harden the softest heart. but forgiveness will soften the hardest heart. There's so much truth to that statement. So that's the fourth way to model biblical marriage, is be quick to forgive. You know, it doesn't matter who you are, you could have the greatest marriage in the world, and there's still going to be hurt, and there's still going to be conflict, and you have to be able to handle it correctly, and one of the first things to do is to forgive. You know, I love what Ruth Graham said. They asked, you know, Ruth, if she'd ever thought about divorcing Billy Graham, the Billy Graham, you know. And she says, no, never thought about divorcing him. Thought a few times about killing him, but never, never about divorcing him. Okay, the fifth way to model biblical marriage is to have realistic expectations. You know, the Bible tells us in Romans 3:23, says, for all have sinned and fall short of God's glory. But yet, sometimes we can treat our spouse as though this verse doesn't apply to them. We can expect so much from them that when they do sin or when they do fall short, it throws us back a little bit, and we're not afraid to let them know it. But the thing of it is, we can be quick to point out the shortcomings of our spouse, but be completely blind to our shortcomings. Because it says, for all have sinned. Not only has our spouse sinned, and not only are they a work in progress, but we are a work in progress as well. It's been said that love is a dream and marriage is an alarm clock. How many woke up to an alarm clock this morning? You know, and you know, you can in the courtship stage and the dating stage, you can be starry-eyed. And I read in preparation for this message, you know, one pastor, he just kind of had to laugh because he had this one couple, and he talked about dealing with problems and issues, and she says, oh, that won't happen to us. We love each other too much. The pastor just shook his head. Marriage is where expectation and reality meet, and for some it can be a collision. All right, marriage is where expectation and reality meet. If we have this type of, it's good to have expectation, but we have to understand that no one is perfect. Okay, and if we're going to hold our spouse to a high expectation, we need to hold ourselves to at least as high or higher of an expectation. And the truth is that closer we get to someone, the more visible the flaws, and therefore the easier it is to get hurt. And that's just a reality of life. You know, someone from a distance can appear so together, you know, and so confident, but as you get to know them better, you know, you maybe see that really underneath they could be insecure, or they could be dealing with issues that you can't see from afar. I like this definition of marriage. It says that marriage is when you agree to spend the rest of your life sleeping in a room that's too warm beside someone who's sleeping in a room that is too cold. How many say that's the kind of marriage I have? Is one is always too warm, the other one's too cold. Yeah. We have unrealistic expectations when we always think our viewpoint is the right one. All right? Honey, it's too cold. No, it's not. As if our opinion is always, it's the law of the land, it's right. You know, sometimes we're going to be right, but sometimes we may not be. But we have unrealistic expectations when we always think we're right. We have unrealistic expectations when we expect more from our spouse than we do ourselves. It's that higher standard that I talked about. We have unrealistic expectations when our focus is on getting rather than giving, putting ourselves first. We have unrealistic expectations when we think our spouse should always understand us and meet all of our needs, because we are so easy to understand. And our needs are so minimal. Why can't you see that? You know, I mean, we can tend to think that and communicate that maybe on a conscious or unconscious level. And then we have unrealistic expectations when we think it is our spouse's job to make us happy. How many of you know, Paul, it's not Deb's job to make you happy. And it's not your job to make Deb happy. Now, obviously, what happens in our marriage is going to affect, you know, our degree of happiness and joy. But if we look to our spouse and put that on our spouse, that I'm not happy and it's because of you, that's a cop-out. Again, it will have some effect, but ultimately we, you know, I like James Dobson, what he says, happiness is a choice. It is something that you and I choose. If you're not a happy single, you probably won't be a happy married individual. And it's on you. It's not on your spouse. Okay? The sixth way to model biblical marriage is to keep romance alive. Ephesians 5:33 says, "Let each individual among you also love his own wife, even as himself. And let the wife see to it that she respect her husband." This is the verse that the Love and Respect series is based on by Emerson Eggerich. The women are to respect their husbands, and the men are to love their wives. And guys, let me tell you a way not to love your wife. All right? This won't go over very big. It says, a man and his wife were shopping. That's starting out good. All right? Guys, that's not the point I'm making. So that's a good start. A man and his wife were shopping at a mall, and a shapely young woman in a short, form-fitting dress strolled by. And the man's eyes followed her. Without looking up from the item that his wife was examining, she said, "Was it worth all the trouble you're just in? You know? Was that one quick glance worth all the trouble that you're going to be in as a result of it?" And what's that? Yeah. Practice. Yeah. Point number. Refer to point number four. Forgiveness. Whatever. Yeah. Understand this: romance done right will meet two of the deepest needs in a marriage relationship. Okay. Romance done right. Number one, it will meet the wife's emotional needs. She will feel loved and valued. She will feel safe and secure. In the 24 years I've done marriage counseling, the number one problem, more than anything else, that causes problems in a marriage is the husband's inability to meet his wife's emotional needs. The wife has an emotional need that the husband generally does not have. And because he doesn't have it, he doesn't realize his wife has that need. And so he treats the wife like he wants to be treated. And therefore, the wife's emotional need goes unmet. And she begins to feel emotionally starved and unloved. But romance done right will meet her emotional needs. Romance done right will meet the man's physical or sexual needs. And as a result, he will feel respected and he will feel understood. Romance is huge in a marriage. In much of today's world, romance has been reduced to nothing more than lustful passion. A woman prostitutes herself with the desperate hope of feeling loved. You know, we're not married, and she is emotionally starving, and she's looking to feel to fill that emotional need, and so she is willing to prostitute herself in hopes that will make her feel loved, and it won't work. cause a man to fulfill his sexual desires at the expense of, regardless of how it makes a woman feel, and regardless of what God's law teaches. God's word is very, very abundantly clear. You know, sex outside of marriage is forbidden. And there are many, many reasons for it. But yet, you look at our culture, you know, the total disregard for that. And so, romance within the marriage will meet the deepest needs of both the husband and the wife that all the sex outside of marriage will never be able to meet. You understand what I'm saying? Romance is a wonderful thing that God has established that will meet the needs of both husband and wife. But the world has reduced it down to nothing but lustful passion and you know, people who engage in sex outside of marriage often will bounce from one person to another thinking that that's where the problem is. And it isn't. It is not doing it God's way. When you do it within the context of marriage, it becomes a very wonderful thing, and God blesses it and anoints it. Two practical words of advice regarding romance, guys. One, ask your spouse to define romance. Okay? I'm so glad my wife's idea is going to a Tiger ball game. Guys, have you ever... when your wife says, I'm going to go watch a chick flick, have you ever studied her and just kind of tried to get inside of her head and think, why? You know what I'm saying? It just, you know, and just like when we say, hey, we're going to go watch a blow-em-up movie, you know, I mean, if there's fire and explosions and all that kind of stuff, then it's good. And not that our wives would ever try to look inside our heads and figure out why we like that. But we have to be careful not to assume, because to us this is romance, that our spouse will see it. Matter of fact, I can just about guarantee what you think is romantic they may not. All right, good communication will help you to understand, because see, you can just pour everything into what you think is a romantic moment, a romantic evening, what you think, but your spouse may not think that. So they may not react the way that you think they should react on this wonderful romantic night, and it ticks you off. You know, and they get ticked off because you're ticked off, because they didn't respond the way you think they should respond. And before the night's over, you have this blow them out, drag them out fight. That's not romantic. Okay? Number two, the first practical way is to ask your spouse to define romance. Secondly, is to budget time and money in your relationship. Understand, guys, when we were courting our wives, we wooed them with dates, with doing fun things. And then we get married, and all of a sudden, some of that stuff comes to an end. You know, almost, we don't ever want to be guilty of a bait and switch. Hey, honey, you marry me, and you know, every Friday night will be, you know, it'll be romance. It'll be just wonderful. And, you know, and you know, we just had this wonderful courtship, and then we get married. Reality, you know. Hey, there's a ball game on Friday night. Yeah, come on, honey, sit down and watch it. What? I thought we were going to go on a date. Well, this is a date. Not that any of the guys here would do that, but budget time and finances into your relationship. You know, this September I'll be celebrating 35 years, and our kids are growing up, and they're all out of the house. And we love our kids. We've poured into our kids. We love our grandkids, and we pour into them. But in the end, it's just my wife and I riding off into the sunset. You understand? And in you can be, you have to understand that. And you have to continue to invest in that relationship. Because at the end of the day, you know, the highest rate of divorce is just as couples move into the empty nest. You know, and I've mentioned this before. And it's because you put so much time and energy and effort into the kids that you don't keep the fires of romance burning in the relationship. The kids are all gone, all that, and then all of a sudden you're looking at each other with all this time on your hands, and you say, who in the heck are you, you know? And you feel really distant from one another, and I'll kind of address that in a minute. But so invest. You know, if you don't have a lot of money, there's a lot of things that you can do. Because, guys, I'll tell you something. You know what wives are really interested in? It's not the big houses. Well, they probably like that, too. But what they want more than anything else is us. They want our time. If it's a walk down, you know, the river trail, most women, you know, that I know, they're not fussy. They want us. You know, they want their husband. They want the time and the attention and so on and so forth. So just a couple of practical things. Define romance so you both have a clear understanding and invest in your relationship. Yeah, yeah. Spoken like a true woman. If you didn't hear her, she said, and look at your spouse the same way you looked at that girl in the short skirt at the mall. Yeah. Okay. The final thing I want to talk about, the final way we can model biblical marriage is to guard against distractions. All right. Let's take a look at Luke 10, verse 38 through 42. Familiar with this story, it says, now as they were traveling along, Jesus entered a village, and a woman named Martha welcomed him into her home. She had a sister called Mary who was seated at the Lord's feet, listening to his word. But Martha was distracted with all of her preparations, and she came to him and said, Lord, do you not care that my sister has left me to do all the serving alone? Then tell her to help me. But the Lord answered and said to Martha, he said, Martha, Martha, you are worried and bothered about so many things, but only one thing is necessary. For Mary has chosen the good part, which shall not be taken away from her. And, you know, the main point of this verse is so much more important to have a Mary relationship with Christ rather than a Martha relationship, right? With a Martha relationship, and some of the versions use the word distracted. And we, with a Martha relationship with the Lord, we can be busy with so many things that we're distracted from what is really, really important. That is that personal relationship with Christ. But the same principle applies in our marriage, is that we can be so busy with life and we can have a Martha marriage rather than a Mary marriage. You understand the difference there? And we have to be careful because it can become very easy to be distracted in the relationships that matter the most. Because you know that they'll take the most, they'll kind of stretch the furthest. You know, you don't want to offend this person, but it's all right to, you know, maybe take advantage a little bit of the marriage relationship. And understand this, that life pulls us from many different directions. Our kids can become an idol in our life if we're not careful. And but not only our kids, finances, work, friendships, hobbies, there can be so many things that we're always on the go, we're always keeping busy. And when it comes to having that sitting at each other's feet sort of and just engaging in just a personal intimate relationship, that can quickly be gone. Healthy relationships require sufficient time and attention. And it's a priority issue. I want to share five things the five biggest mistakes that threaten relationships, according to a Dr. Edward and Sue Hollowell. Okay? Dr. Edward and Sue Hollowell. And this is what they had to say about the five biggest mistakes. Number one, mistake number one, is what they call screen sucking. Screen sucking. It's where you say, I'm just going to go check my email, honey. And 2 hours later, you're still there. Dr. Hollowell says, noting that an interactive screen can suck you in, and before you know it, hours have passed spending mindless time on the computer. Boy, is it quiet in here. Let's face it, you know, we live in an age where so often our face is in front of a screen. If it's in front of a screen, it's not going to be, you know, engaging with our spouse. And you know, again, there's we just got to have a proper balance. How many have seen the commercial on TV where a guy wants to give a birthday present or a, some type of gift to his spouse is in a restaurant? And she's down texting. And he tries to get her attention. And he looks around, and everybody in the restaurant is you know, on their phones texting. And finally, he gets his phone up and texts her a message across the table. And she looks up, and he gives the gift, and you know, a happy moment. That is a pretty good reflection of our society and our culture right now, okay? You know, there's a lot of screen sucking going on out there, and they said that that is one of the biggest mistakes that we can make, is spending too much time with, you know, in front of a screen and not enough time in front of our spouse. Secondly, the second problem is that of overbooking. He says, don't become a victim to your own enthusiasm. It's when you have so many things that you put on your plate, volunteering, dealing with the kids, seeing your friends, that you really don't have time to pay attention to the things that you really need to pay attention to. To become close to one another, you must pay attention. It's important to do this repeatedly over time. Be careful not to overbook. You have to, you know, if you're one that really keeps a close schedule, schedule afternoon with my spouse. Draw a line all the way through so that nothing else can creep in there. You know, if you, you know, live by a tight schedule, then schedule time with that. But, you know, it's funny, Nancy Ann and I work here, and she has to schedule time. We have to schedule time together to be able to communicate effectively. And, you know, people assume because we're married that they tell her that I hear about it, or if they tell me, I tell her. And one thing is, as a pastor, there are certain things that you can't tell. So I had this file where, you know, a do not repeat file. And so someone tells me something, I know I can't repeat it. I put it in there and lock it away. And once in a while, things that I can tell and share slips into that file. You know, things like so-and-so had a baby and... You know, but it's amazing that even as husband and wife, and we're together all the time. We work together. We live together. You know, and but it's still hard to have that time to communicate. It interesting. Okay, number three, the five biggest mistakes that threaten relationships is having no boundaries. The great thing about modern life is that we've broken all boundaries. The danger about modern life is that we've broken down all boundaries. Dr. Holloway says, so you're out to lunch with your best friend and you take a call. See, we're available anywhere, anytime to the world, which is great as long as we're in charge. But when it's in charge of us, life goes out the window. Avoid this by turning off your electronic devices when you are with your spouse. Don't allow others to intrude upon your life with each other. You understand that? If the phone rings, you don't have to answer it. I think one of the greatest inventions of mankind is caller ID. And voicemails and answering machines. You know what I'm saying? And what's that? Well, you know, that's caller ID can help with that. But if you sit down to a nice dinner and you want to have a nice conversation with your spouse, and if it's 6 o'clock and the phone rings and the caller ID says March of Dimes or you fill in the blank, I ain't gonna answer that thing. I'm not gonna ruin my dinner. But yet, if it's a friend, a real friend will wait and they'll understand. They'll not want to bother your dinner. You know what I'm saying? You know, as a kid, did you guys do this as a kid? When the phone rang, now I grew up with 5 brothers and a sister. My sister never got involved in this, but 6 of us boys did. The phone rang. We had, you know, I think we invented the WWF, the World Wide Wrestling Federation, because we all wanted to go answer the phone. And it was a knockdown, drag them out fight to see who was going to get to the phone. And then we raised our kids, and it was just the opposite. Phone rang. You get it. I don't want it. You get it. And but I think much of society has swung back to the, you know, got to get this phone call. And we have to have boundaries, all right? We have to have enough respect for one another. You know, if someone calls me and schedules an appointment to see me, I'll give them an hour of my time. And I'll let the phone ring off the hook out of respect and courtesy for them. But if they just happen to drop in, then I'll take a phone call if I get one, because it wasn't a time that they had scheduled and so on and so forth. Now, there's been a few times where I'll be meeting with somebody, and if I'm the only one here, the phone will ring, and it'll stop. A minute or two later, it'll ring again. And after about the third or fourth time, I said, somebody's trying to reach me. And they said, yeah, you better answer it. You know. But we have to make boundaries, all right? And it's a matter of respecting one another and loving one another enough to say, you know what, I'm not going to let, you know, a phone call that can wait and get in the way. Okay? Does that make sense to everybody? Number 4 is getting too busy. This is when you are doing too many things at one time. He says, I'll be attending to everything else, and Ned will be like, will you just spend a few minutes talking to me? Sue explains. Don't make yourself too busy during the day that when you get home, all you want to do is check out and not connect with your partner. You can be so busy that you come home and you are exhausted, and all you want to do is just sit in front of the TV. And you know, your spouse, if they haven't seen you all day, and they want to connect with you, they want to talk with you, and you can become so tired that your quality time lacks quality. All right, and then the final mistake. The threatened relationships that he talks about is that of drifting apart. He said, drifting apart is a passive action, just allowing your relationship to wither away without taking action to stop it or believing that you can take care of it at a later time. That old saying of pay me now, pay me later. Our message is that you absolutely do have a choice, Dr. Holloway says. And Sue adds that it's important to take control of your life instead of letting your life take control of you. And I would dare say there's a lot of couples who see that there's a distance growing in the relationship, and the gap seems to be getting better. But you know it might be painful to deal with it. So you just hope magically you wake up one day and it's all back together and everything is hunky-dory. But the reality of it is you have to address the issue. And the longer you wait, the more of a distance that will be created, and the more drifting that you'll do, and the more difficult it will be to come back together. So if you sense a drifting apart, you want to be able to sit down and there's so many good books and video series out there and so many good people to talk to. They can help you figure out a way to come back together and have a healthy, godly marriage. So those are five things that he talked about. And so I'm just for a second, I want to recap this week. Be quick to forgive. Have realistic expectations. Keep romance alive. And guard against distractions. In an age of technology, distractions will come more now than maybe ever before. So we have to be very careful. And it's an act of love when we do that and our wife and our husband sees that. So I want to close this way. I want to pray for all the marriages. So if you're married, please stand. And someday if you hope to be married, you can stand as well.